This is July 6, 2014, in London. Question and answer. So you had a question, yes?
Yeah, I was thinking that we are in the material world, so we are not in the spirit, we are not living in the spiritual world. So how do we practice spiritual happiness?
How do we practice spiritual happiness when we're not in the spiritual world? Well, illusion. Oh, he's telling me I have to be quiet? Listen. Do I have to be quiet too? Is this like a library? So it's explained that illusion is only within the mind. So in one sense, one can say that this is the inferior energy and there's a superior energy. But in another sense, everything is also spiritual. Sarva Kalam Idam Brahma. Everything is spiritual. So we can experience even Krishna's inferior energy, Bhumirapanalo, Vayukam, Mano, Buddha, Evacha, as also Krishna's energy. And therefore, it is entirely possible to experience spiritual happiness even within a material body in the material world if we have our consciousness that this is Krishna's energy and it's ultimately spiritual.
In the spiritual world, we don't have the material bodies.
No, you don't have a material body in the spiritual world. Your spiritual body is fully manifested.
What is the spiritual body like?
What is the spiritual body like? Well, just like there's so many varieties of bodies here, there's so many varieties of spiritual bodies. But the spiritual body is the real self. It's not a covering of the self. It's the real self. And it's eternal, it's ever youthful, it's beautiful, it's powerful, it's full of knowledge, full of happiness. But that's our real body. So this is a covering. Our material body is like a covering of clothing on top of our spiritual body.
Well, the spiritual body will have all the things, all the senses, like mind.
Oh yes, all the senses, but our senses are much better. The spiritual senses are much better.
And in the spiritual world, we don't have to do this housework and cooking, etc.
No, well, they do these things sometimes just because it's fun. But there's no necessity.
That means if they do it, that means they feed the body, but body...
But no, the body doesn't have to eat. It's just some sort of pleasure. So here, our activities all have a function. There, nothing has a function. It's just play. So there's the original form of eating and walking and talking and swimming. And the original form exists there. But there, it's all play. There, we call it pastimes. Just like we've had this World Cup. So the World Cup is a pastime. It's not necessary. Nobody needs to have a World Cup in order to exist. It doesn't serve some essential function. It's just a pastime, we call that. Yes, we use that word. It's a pastime, something to pass the time, something that's enjoyable. So in spiritual existence, there's no need of any function. Everything is eternal. And there's
no hobby.
Everything is like a hobby. Everything is just a game. Everything is just fun. But what's interesting is that spiritual activities, although they're just fun, they're full of real meaning because they're in relationship to loving Krishna. Whereas material things, even though they have a function, are ultimately meaningless. What is the meaning of maintaining a body for a few years that's just going to be a pile of ashes at the end? What kind of meaning is there in that? And it isn't our eternal identity. It doesn't really have much meaning. And, you know, within 50 years after we've died, practically speaking, nobody will remember us anymore. Certainly within 100 years, nobody will remember us anymore. And everything we did will be like sandcastles on the beach. All of the hard work, all of the effort, all of the... It just turns into ashes and forgetfulness. So it's interesting that although in material consciousness everything seems to have value because it has some function. You have to build a house because people need shelter, and you have to grow food because people need to eat. Really, it's very meaningless. Whereas spiritually, although nothing has any particular function other than to express love and increase love, that's its only function. There's no necessity of anything. Yet it has deep meaning, deep and real and eternal meaning. It has real value.
So how do we raise our consciousness to that level so we can be in real spiritual happiness?
Well, that's really our whole system of bhakti yoga. And the system of bhakti yoga is the basic system of spirituality that's been taught by every system of religion and spirituality, every bona fide system. I mean, there are some made-up systems, just like there are some universities that just give you a degree for £100 without doing any work. But as far as real schools, thank you so much. Just like all real schools, they teach 2 + 2 = 4. So in all real spiritual traditions, they teach that the essence is to love God, to dedicate everything to God. So that is bhakti yoga. I was just reading today in the Bhagavatam how the essence of bhakti yoga is to always remember Krishna at every moment, to be absorbed in Krishna, to be absorbed in the spiritual, so as to absorb our mind in the spiritual. And the activities that we do are meant to help us to do that. The activities we do both will, if done properly, they will facilitate that absorption of consciousness, and if one's consciousness is already absorbed, they will express that absorption of consciousness. Something like, if you want a loving relationship with someone, you may buy them a flower, or you may give them something to eat. So giving somebody food or giving somebody flowers develops love that's not yet fully developed, and it expresses love that's already there. It has both those functions. Correct? Yes. So giving food to someone both develops love that's not yet there and expresses love that's already there. So there are certain activities that tend to do that more than others. Giving people flowers tends to do that more than giving people bicycle parts. Right? There's certain activities that tend to develop and increase love, and certain activities that don't generally tend to do that. They may do it in some circumstances, but they don't generally tend to do that. So Rupa Goswami gives us 3 categories: gifts, food, and confidences, that where we give them and receive them, it tends to develop and express love. And you'll find that the activities of bhakti yoga are all expansions of those. So if you love somebody, you talk about them, you think about them, you say their name, you do things to please them. You talk to them. You take care of people who are dear to them. You give things to them. You give yourself to them. You give your time to them. So if you examine all the different activities of bhakti yoga, you can fit them into all of those, into those basic categories. So if we don't yet have absorption in Krishna, by doing those things while cultivating an attachment for Krishna, not just mechanically, then they will bring about that spiritual absorption. And as they bring about that spiritual absorption, doing those things expresses and increases that absorption that you already have. So if you do the processes of bhakti yoga in a mechanical way, then it will take a very, very, very long time for them to be effective, because the idea is to develop a spiritual consciousness. So please don't think that when we talk about doing bhakti yoga, we're talking about just something that's ritualistic or mechanical. Just say this mantra mechanically, or just say these prayers and offer your food mechanically, like it's some kind of a ritual. I mean, that will have some benefit very, very slowly. But if you really want to develop spiritual consciousness, then it's a question of absorbing your mind in spiritual consciousness. And these activities aid in doing that. But you have that as your goal. You have that as your resolve. Yes?
Ozzy, you mentioned that we should not think that we're chanting hands materially, but mechanically. I've got a friend who's been in Krishna consciousness, or drifting in and out of Krishna consciousness, for the last 10.5 years. He's a very good person, very scientific minded, but he has difficulty chanting. So he understands the philosophy, all of that, but as far as chanting is concerned, he's not interested. And he said, I just don't feel like chanting. And I don't know how I could perhaps help him.
Well, one can attain success through any of the 9 processes of devotion. So my suggestion would be that get him to engage in a process that he really does like, and then that he'll naturally also want to chant later. So if there's something else that he likes. Like I've met people, actually I met somebody here in London many years ago, who said, I just can't read the scriptures. And I said, well, why? What's the problem? She said, well, I've heard that we're supposed to start with Bhagavad Gita, but I don't like Bhagavad Gita. So because I've heard we're supposed to start with Bhagavad Gita and I don't like the Bhagavad Gita, I read nothing. I said, okay, is there a book that you like? And she said, I love the Nectar Devotion. I said, well, why don't you read that then? So Prabhupada also says we should perform the processes according to our personal taste. So if one hasn't yet made vows, has he got initiated yet? Has he taken vows?
He did, unfortunately, not yet. I mean,
okay, well, that's a little serious. That means that there's some offense involved. But anyway, you ask him, what does he like to do? And suggest that he does that instead of sitting around thinking about what he doesn't like to do. And as he does what he likes to do, and that attachment to Krishna increases, and he'll find that he also likes chanting. But frankly, for each of us, there are certain processes in bhakti that each of us find easier and certain processes each of us find more difficult due to our particular personality, our nature, our previous lives, and so forth. I mean, I have there's one good friend of mine who told me as soon as she came to Krishna consciousness and she heard about chanting on beads, she said, oh, I can do that. And she loves doing that, and she was just, you know, immediately started chanting 16 rounds, and very quickly she kept adding and adding and adding. She said by the time she got to 40, she figured maybe she should stop adding so she could also do other things. Because I was asking her, I was with her in India a few years ago, and every day she would say, okay, I'm going to chant my afternoon rounds now. And after a few days I said, how come you always chant afternoon rounds? And then she told me her story, and she said, well, I have, you know, I chant like 20 rounds in the morning and 20 rounds in the afternoon. And she said, I could easily chant 80 or 90 rounds, but I figure I should do other service. So there's some people like that. You know, some people who just love kirtan and bhajan, and they can just all day, they can do kirtan and bhajan. Where other people, I know other people who are like, well, I really like Krishna consciousness, but I'm not so into kirtan. And we find that. And other people who just love deity worship, and other people who just, they're really not into deity worship. So we have our personal tastes, and that's true due to our material conditioning. Whatever we've done in previous lives, whatever we're like in this life, we have certain things that we particularly like and certain things that we don't particularly like. And then that also becomes true as one matures spiritually. So as one goes on at the higher levels of bhakti, one will have certain spiritual activities that one particularly likes more than others. Yeah. I mean, Srila Prabhupada did give us, especially if we take promises, 16 rounds for everybody. Better that somebody does something rather than nothing. So if somebody is, you know, they're not willing to chant, so they're not doing anything, better to be engaged in what they like than nothing. And that will come.
So one of the things he's now doing is keeping a distance from the devotees, because everyone keeps telling him chanting is the yuga dharma, and you must be doing that.
That sounds like a really good way to help people advance in Krishna consciousness.
It takes a long time.
I don't know if I want to say much more about that. That's, I'm going to get angry if I say much more. So let's make somebody feel guilty every time they come to the temple for what they're not doing, so they don't want to come to the temple anymore and never do anything. It doesn't sound like a very... It doesn't really sound like the example that we see from the acharyas. I mean, if you're that person's guru, you can say that to them. That's another thing. If you're their guru, you can say, hey, what are you doing? You promised me. But that should be the guru. Also, to understand just a little psychology. So it was many years ago in this room, I was talking to one lady who stopped chanting. She had taken initiation, and she'd taken a vow to chant 16 rounds, and she had stopped chanting regularly. So she asked me, well, you know, what can I do? And she said, I just feel so guilty, and I feel so bad about it, and I feel so terrible about it. And I realized that what she had done was she had established what we call a negative trigger. Are you all familiar with triggers? What triggers are? So do any of you have a smell that when you smell a certain smell, it brings on a certain emotional state? How many of you have a smell that brings on a particular emotional state? Okay, or a certain kind of food? You have a certain kind of food? Any of you have a certain kind of food that brings on a certain emotional state? What about music? Any of you have a piece of music?
Yeah.
Brings on a particular piece of music. A certain place? Okay, could be a certain time, a certain activity. So these things are called triggers. There are certain what we call sensory input that trigger emotions in us. They don't exactly trigger a memory, they trigger emotions. You know, we smell cinnamon and we get this emotion of warmth and love because our grandmother used to make apple pie with cinnamon. And so what's happened was the feelings we have about our grandmother become connected to that cinnamon smell. And these triggers are formed either by one strong experience or by repeated weak experiences. You know, if you were driving someplace and you had a car accident, like there was a friend of mine who got in a very bad car accident on the way to an airport. I mean, a really, 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 really bad car accident. It took her 6 months of physical therapy and many surgeries in order to function again. So it was a very severe car accident. Her husband also had never fully recovered, and many, many operations, much time in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she was telling me that whenever she packed a suitcase, that she would feel fear and anxiety. That makes sense? Do you understand? As soon as she'd start to pack a suitcase, she'd just freeze. Why? Because the suitcase had become a trigger for her for all the pain and suffering she went through in the accident. And I had an experience many years ago. I used to like to walk down our long driveway to pick up the mail from the post box. And my children used to say to me, Mata, why do you like to get the mail? You know, and then I remembered, I was thinking, why do I like to get the mail? Why do I like to get the mail? And then I realized that when we were renovating a building to make it into a school, one devotee had sent us a donation, a check for $35,000. And when I went down to the mailbox, and I saw this, and I opened it up while I was standing at the mailbox, and I said, oh, here's a check for $35,000. So the mailbox had become a trigger for me, for the feeling I had when I opened that envelope. And so I always like to go back to the mailbox. So we should be very, very careful about what triggers we set up for people in relationship to Krishna consciousness. If every time a person thinks about their japa, all they feel is guilt, they're less likely to chant. And as soon as they think about japa, all they think is guilt. So I remember with that woman I was talking to here, and she was saying, you know, I'm so bad, I'm just not chanting, I feel so guilty. The only thing she had to say about chanting were all negative. They're all negative emotions. So I said, listen, instead of thinking about the chanting you're not doing, why don't you think about the chanting you are doing? Whatever chanting you're doing, celebrate that. I said, if you chant even one round, just say, yay, I chanted one round today. And change that psychology. So I thought I explained it well, but obviously I didn't, because at the end of that I said, so how many rounds have you chanted? I said, let's try this now, let's practice. So how many rounds have you chanted today? And she said, I have 4 left. So I was, so if we really want people to take up Krishna consciousness, then it would probably be a very good idea to associate positive emotional experiences with what they're doing right, and not associate negative emotional experiences with whatever things that they're failing to do. If we genuinely want to encourage them, instead of just making ourselves feel good that we're better than they are, that's another thing, if that's our motive. But if we just want to say, oh, look at him, then go ahead and make them feel guilty and harass them about it all the time. But if you really want to encourage people, I'd say encourage them in what they like to do and help them celebrate whatever they're doing right. And that would be far more pleasing to Krishna and to Srila Prabhupada and to our acharyas. Any other questions? Yes?
Mataji, we say those children, like when the children are playing or when they're doing something wrong, we spontaneously say that, you know, don't do that, something wrong, you know, which you're doing. Just stop doing that now. And sometimes if they don't listen, we try to order them. Is it like
stop it right now.
Stop it right now, you know. You cannot do this anymore. But when it comes to us...
You have to do that when you're a parent. That's part of your job.
But when it comes to us, though we know if we are doing something wrong with the child, you know, like stopping him from doing, without telling something in a positive way, how can we do that?
Practice. How do you change any habit is by practice. So, or you just think, what do I want my child to do instead? Especially if all you say is stop it. Stop it.
What's
it? I have a good friend like this, and she chats with me over Skype, and she'll say things to me like, you know, he was really upset about that. Who was really upset about what? She does that frequently. So, didn't your teachers teach you that you had to have antecedents for your pronouns? So if you just say, stop it, your poor child hasn't the foggiest notion of what they're supposed to do. And let's say they're jumping on the couch. Even if you're more specific and you say, stop jumping on the couch. So what do you want them to do? Do you want them to sit on the couch? Do you want them to stand on the couch? Do you want them to get off the couch? Do you want them to play outside? What do you want them to do? And I'll tell you frankly, often we don't know what we want them to do, because when I teach this kind of thing, and to parents particularly, and I say, instead of telling your child what you don't want them to do, tell them what you do want them to do, many times the parents get a blank expression on their face because they don't know what they want the child to do. Now, if you don't know what you want your child to do, how is your child, who's a child, going to figure that out? You know, if you, as the adult, have the foggiest notion of what you want them to do, and you've got to think about it for a few minutes, so how do you expect them to figure it out? So this is practice, 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 practice. As you practice, at first it will be difficult, and gradually it will come naturally. So as soon as you, you might say the negative thing first, but then catch yourself. Stop it. Please sit on the couch. Just ask, what do I want them to do instead? And even if you say the negative thing first due to bad habit, what do I want them to do instead? What do I want them to do instead? Now, having said that, it is very useful to have a do not list in our lives. It's useful to have a to-do list and also a not-to-do. So not-to-do lists are definitely helpful. I will not gossip. I will not criticize. I will not complain. I will not read the news till I finish my rounds. Whatever it may be. You follow?
Yes.
But even those should be quite specific. All right? But this is just practice, practice, practice. And at first it's hard, and at first it's awkward, and at first you'll make mistakes. That's true with anything that you're trying to change.
And the question is very silly, but I want to ask, the parents are arguing.
I don't believe it's a really silly question, or else you wouldn't ask, but go ahead.
The parents are arguing, and the child is observing it, is it?
Yes.
And sometimes the child keenly observes as well. Like,
okay.
Know, why are they doing this?
Yes.
And the child comes out with conclusions like, oh, they are arguing, so I can also do that sometimes.
So you're telling me the parents argue, the child observes the parents arguing, and this teaches the child that they can argue. Are you telling me that if children do not see their parents arguing, that they will not argue?
No. When the child observes, and if he takes him in a negative way, how to bring it to
the positive? How to have the observing of your parents' arguments be positive for the child?
Yes.
If the child sees that you settle your arguments and you keep on loving each other and you stay together, that would be very positive. But please make your arguments not be really mean and nasty and cruel. Argue with respect and with love, please. Honey, I hate it when you do that! Is much better than just, I hate it when you do that. So, you know, something that reminds you that I'm not supposed to like this person. It's very good for children to see that my parents argue sometimes and they still love each other. And believe me, your children will know how to argue just fine even if you never demonstrate it to them. They'll learn it from somebody else, or they'll just learn it intrinsically. I think we all know how to argue. Yes. Why don't I ask somebody else? Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I have a limited amount of time here. Yes.
So the Prabhupada said that we have to place ourselves in a mode of goodness in order to progress spiritually.
Okay.
How do we measure how we get in the mode of goodness?
Okay, so Prabhupada says we should place ourselves in the mode of goodness in order to advance spiritually. How do we measure how much we're in the mode of goodness?
Now, what is the threshold of influence of goodness? we're always influenced by other modes.
What do you mean by threshold?
Like, probably not the threshold, the level of being the percentage.
How much goodness do you need?
To be considered in the world.
Okay, so what I think you're saying is, Prabhupada said we need to be in goodness to advance spiritually. However, in the material world, there's always a mixture of the modes. So how much goodness do you need to have to call it goodness?
Yeah.
Was that your question?
Yes, sir.
50%.
50?
Yes. How do you measure that?
Yes. So it means half of the day you're...
That was good. That was really good.
Can we actually do that?
No, of course not. No, that was good. So for your waking hours, half of your waking hours, you're purely, completely in goodness, and the other half, you're completely in passion ignorance. That, first of all, that's impossible. You simply couldn't do that. It wouldn't be possible. How do you measure that you reach 50% of the mode of goodness? Though you reach the symptoms of nistha, or steadiness. And those symptoms are explained briefly in Madhurya Kadambini and also in the Bhagavatam, first canto, second chapter. First of all, you become very, very happy. So your first symptom of being at least 50% in the mode of goodness is you become very, very happy. You also get a feeling of freedom. You get a sense of detachment. Your body, mind, words, and good qualities are steadily engaged in Krishna consciousness. Not totally, absolutely, but you don't have ups and big up and down swings anymore. Before you have at least 50% in the mode of goodness, you're just riding on these waves of modes. Whenever people ask, how do I think of Krishna all the time? How do I? That means they haven't reached that point yet. Otherwise, they wouldn't be asking that question. So that's... other symptoms, you start being steady, like I said, in the good qualities, the 26 qualities of a devotee. You start being kind and merciful. You start being poetic, expert, not eating too much, not feeling that you have material possessions. And again, these are not happening absolutely, totally, but they're becoming your general experience. It becomes your general experience. You're treating friends and enemies equally. You're seeing pebble, stone, gold is the same. Your determination is not affected by honor, dishonor, heat and cold, happiness, distress, fame and infamy, auspicious situations, inauspicious situations. Your determination remains steady in success or failure. Generally. That will be your general. You'll notice the modes of passion and ignorance, but they won't affect you very much. You won't identify with them very much. So we had a nice experience in the car the other night driving to Crowley. So there were three of us in the car driving from London to Crowley, and we got in a very bad traffic jam. So we were moving, but very, very, very slowly and with great difficulty. It was a big struggle. Now, of course, it was also nice because there were three of us in the car and we're all friends, and so we were enjoying each other's company. And therefore, in bhakti yoga, even before you're 50% goodness, it's still fun because the process is still fun. So even though you're in a traffic jam and it's a struggle, you still have Krishna and the devotees. And then at a certain point, the traffic jam just sort of dissipated. So we were still in a car. We weren't flying. You know, we were still in a car. And there were still other cars on the road. And one still had to drive, and one still had to give some attention to driving. But everything was very easy. And we were going very fast. So another symptom is, Prabhupada says, until the stage of nistha, it's a hard struggle with determination. Afterwards, everything is very easy. That doesn't mean there's no determination, but it's very easy. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur also explains that until that point, that your mind is wandering to material subjects, you don't even notice it's wandered to material subjects, and it takes you a long time even to notice. It's kind of like someone who's walking an animal, and the animal runs off, and they don't even notice. And, oh my goodness, where's my dog? So it's like one devotee once said to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, sometimes we fall into Maya. Prabhupada said, no, you're always in Maya, sometimes you fall into Krishna. So if you're at the stage where you're always in Maya and sometimes you fall into Krishna, that means you're less than 50% in the mode of goodness. By the time you get to the mode of goodness, the mind will still wander to Maya, but it's primarily in Krishna. And when it starts to wander to Maya, you can very quickly bring it back. You very quickly notice, oh, hey, come back. Before that, you know, you're like all the way off the road. Oh. But at that point, you very quickly, oh, and you come back. It's still an effort. There's still some endeavor and there's still some effort, but it's very easy. And it's not a sense of a struggle anymore. And when you get further advanced, you're automatically in Krishna, and even if there's material engagements, your mind automatically goes to Krishna. But those are some symptoms. Is that helpful for you? And of course, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, especially the 17th and 18th chapter, gives a whole list of things in the different modes of nature. And so you can see what are the symptoms of the mode of goodness. Primary things in goodness, things are done with the proper object, at the proper time, at the proper place, and with a consciousness of desire for purification. One is not doing things for the adoration of the public or for the ego of thinking you're a good person. And one is doing things according to proper time and place, with the proper object. You see things. Anyway, you go through that list, it's a long list. Is that okay? By the way, you don't need to be at that point to start bhakti. You can start bhakti from the mode of ignorance. You don't need to first come to 50% goodness, and then you can do bhakti. Because what will you be doing to get to 50% goodness? If someone thinks, first I have to come to 50% goodness, and then I can do bhakti, what process do they think is bringing them to 50% goodness? So it's bhakti that's bringing us to goodness. You understand? We're not trying to come to goodness and then do bhakti. We're just doing bhakti, and bhakti automatically brings us to goodness. However, you can say that it's only at that point that really bhakti begins. You can say bhakti only begins from that platform. Something like when you're driving, when you're in a traffic jam, it's almost like your journey hasn't even begun yet. I mean, it has, but you're not really making any progress. Or very, 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 very little. You follow? You're in your car and you're going somewhere, but you know, if it's taking you 20 minutes to go a quarter of a mile, you can say you haven't really gone anywhere. You haven't really started your journey. You follow?
Sorry, can you give an example of when we do bhakti and bring us to mind goodness naturally?
How does bhakti bring... Well, what is goodness? Goodness, sattva gun. Sattva also means truth. So what you're doing in bhakti is you're absorbing yourself in the truth. It's like you're taking a bath in the truth. So it naturally brings you the truth because that's what you're doing. You're absorbing sattva. Param sattva dhimihi. You're meditating on the absolute truth. Bhakti means you're thinking of Krishna. Bhakti does not mean waving some incense and putting your fingers on some beads. That's not what bhakti means. Bhakti means absorption of Krishna. And the purpose of waving your incense and putting your fingers on the beads is to absorb yourself in Krishna. That is its function. And once you've already absorbed yourself in Krishna, it's your function is to express that absorption and increase that absorption. But the whole key is absorption and attachment with love in Krishna. That is bhakti. Bhakti is nothing else but that. So if you're doing that, if you're absorbing your mind with attachment in Krishna, then Krishna is the absolute truth, and naturally you'll be absorbed in truth. Now, how exactly does that happen? The way it seems to happen is that Krishna says, Gyanadipena Bhasvata, he turns on a light in the heart. And when he turns on a light in the heart, you get to see what is the ignorance, what is the passion, what is the goodness. You see clearly, and then you can make a choice. That seems to be the way that it happens. Is that clear? You know, because until the heart lights up, you can't even distinguish truth from falsity. Like in the mode of ignorance, you think falsity is truth and truth is falsity. Like people who think going out at night and drinking alcohol and vomiting in the gutter is enjoyment. They think that's enjoyment, and they think sitting in a temple chanting Hare Krishna is suffering. So they have it backwards. And then you have in the mode of passion, you're kind of confused. So in the mode of passion, you might be a vegetarian, but you might have an abortion. You know, you're kind of confused. So you get something's right and you get something's wrong. The mode of ignorance, you're just backwards. So you can't see clearly. You're foggy. You don't see what's right and what's wrong. You don't see what's beneficial for you, what's not beneficial for you. You don't know what's liberating, what's binding. You can't even evaluate your own behaviors when you're in ignorance and passion. You look at yourself and you say, well, I'm a good person. I make some mistakes, but I have a good heart and I have good motivations and I really care. And that's all a bunch of nonsense if you're a materialistic person. It's just not true at all. But we see ourselves like that when we're covered by passion and ignorance. We think, you know, that we're wonderful people and we're good-hearted and we're kind and we're caring and we have, you know. So the light goes on and then you can see, woohoo, you know, I'm not like that. What am I doing? And what are the consequences of what I'm doing? What are my real motives? You see your real motives clearly, which is quite shocking, by the way. And you see your actions quite clearly. You really see everything very clearly. And then at that point, you have to choose. You have to decide, what do I want to do? And then Krishna helps you. So when you come in touch with Krishna, he helps you by revealing. And when you choose, he helps you to make that choice. It's something like if you had some, you know, garage that you hadn't cleaned out for, you know, 25 years and you've just been throwing stuff in there. And one day you decided to clean it out and so you ask a friend of yours to come over and help because you know there's no way you can do it yourself. So you call a friend to come and they come and they help you and the first thing they do is they turn on the light in the garage. Yes? You know, they turn on the light if there's windows, they open the blinds or whatever, and they start looking at things, and they look at things a little differently than you look at things, huh? And they pick something up and they say, you know, what is this? Oh, you know, that's from my great-great-grandmother, it's been in my family for 10 generations. Yes, but it's broken and it's full of mold, and do you ever use it? And no, but it's... So it's like that. You know, the Krishna comes and he turns on the lights and he opens the windows and he says, this is a piece of junk. And then you have to accept and you have to say, you're right, this is a piece of junk. And then you say, this is just rubbish. Krishna, would you get rid of it? And he says, sure, fine. And he takes and he dumps it out. And if you do that, if you keep Krishna there in your heart, and every time he tells you something's rubbish, you get rid of it. And every time he tells you something's valuable, you clean it, and then very, very quickly you're going to have a clean room. So that's pretty much how it works. Yes?
But lots of times he tells you that it's rubbish, and you say, no, I know it's rubbish, but I'm keeping it.
Then it takes a very long time. Because he won't force you. So... If you get close to Krishna and he reveals, you know, that this is rubbish and you say, no, I want to keep it, then several things will happen. First of all, you won't want to invite Krishna to your heart very much because it will start becoming very uncomfortable. And this is one of the main reasons, by the way, that people stop chanting. Because if you really chant attentively and you really take up the bhakti yoga process attentively, then one of the very first things that will happen is you'll start to see the truth. And we think, oh, that's really cool, I'll see the truth, and it'll be all beautiful and sunny, rainbows, and it is. But you'll see the other stuff too, because you got to get rid of it. And you'll see that. There's just no way around that stage, my dear friends. I'm very sorry, nobody told me about that when I started this process. If I had, I probably wouldn't have started, so I don't know why I tell people this. But, you know, they have proven psychologically, that people are much more likely to stick to something if they know in advance what they're going to run into. So seeing the truth will mean you have to see three things. You're going to see Krishna, who's wonderful and beautiful and incredible and fun and just amazing. And you're going to see yourself. What happens to see yourself? See yourself means you're going to see that you're wonderful and beautiful and amazing, you're a soul, and that you're also a complete, total fool who willingly is engaged in illusion. You'll see that. You'll see it's like you're a diamond that willingly jumped into the sewer. You see both the things about yourself. And then you'll see the nature of illusion. Prabhupada says you'll see the naked form of material desires. You see illusion for what it is. You see the materialistic interactions and motives and desires for what they are, and they're quite ugly. Illusion is really quite ugly. It's quite disgusting. So you'll see those three things, and then you have to choose. If you choose wrongly, you'll feel very uncomfortable to have the light on. It's very uncomfortable to make wrong choices knowing that you're making wrong choices. Just like in some parts of America, they have a law that before a woman can have an abortion, they have to do an ultrasound, they have to show her that the baby's moving, because they know it's very difficult for the woman to kill her child when she really has to see that it's a child. It's still possible, obviously, but it's difficult. It's easier if you don't know what you're doing, if you forget about what you're doing. This is why in war, generally, the enemy is called by different names, gooks and chinks and whatever. They make up some name. And the enemy is often seen as to be subhuman, as to be some kind of animal. This is often done in, racism and things. You put some kind of fog. This is what's in meat eating. Why don't we take children on tours of slaughterhouses? We take them to McDonald's where there's a little drawing of some cow smiling. And there's some, advertisement with hamburgers growing on trees. You've seen these sort of things, yes?
Yeah.
Why don't they show the children what really happens? Because then a few people would, but hardly anybody would eat the meat anymore. Even, in the slaughterhouses, there's only a tiny fraction of people who actually slaughter the animals. Even most people who work in the slaughterhouses can't deal with it. So the only way to continue to do something that's harmful and evil is not to see it for what it is. If you see evil for what it is, and to choose to keep on doing it is extremely difficult. Kind of will make you a little nuts after a while. So when you're in the light of the truth, you either have to choose truth or get out of the light is what happens. And so a lot of people who don't want to choose the truth, they sort of kind of do, somewhat, but they don't really. They sort of, they want to be spiritual. They want to be spiritual, but they don't want to get rid of the illusion. They want to kind of see the truth while being an illusion. And just, you can't do that. It doesn't make the slightest bit of sense. I can't be false and live in the truth. How do you do that? It doesn't make sense. How can I have an authentic relationship with you if I'm wearing a mask? I just can't. If I want an authentic relationship with you, then I have to be authentic. This isn't a logical alternative. So there's a lot of people who want to be spiritual, but they don't want to get rid of the pretense. They don't want to get rid of the deceit. They don't want to get rid of the evil in their hearts. It's embarrassing, and it's very briefly painful. It's not long-term painful, but briefly it is painful. And it's embarrassing, and it's briefly, very briefly difficult. So when people hit that, a lot of people back off. And they still keep some connection with the spiritual because they want to feel spiritual. I'm very spiritual. But they don't really want that. They're afraid. So the only cure is to just do it and find out that it's nice and it doesn't hurt for more than a moment. And then it feels so good that you got rid of all this junk and you have a beautiful heart. Is that right? And then you get to a point where that's not what spiritual life is about at all anymore. And once you've done that, then spiritual life is not a matter of cleaning the heart anymore. It's a matter of just developing your relationship with love and being absorbed in the spiritual world and meditating on your eternal relationship and awakening your spiritual body and getting into your eternal rasa with Krishna and the eternal relationship with all the people in the spiritual world and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you could compare it to, I have a family whose son became a heroin addict. So they still love him, but they will not let him in the house because he will steal. So if he wants to be part of the family again, he's got to go to treatment. And it will be difficult. And there will be some pain, and there will be some austerity, and there will be some, and there will have to be some remorse. And he'll have to be able to say to his parents, I really messed up, and I really messed up my life, and I really messed up my relationship with you. And but he won't have to say that eternally. You understand? Once that's said, and once that's done, it's done. And then he comes back in the house and he's part of the family again. And if he just keeps staying part of the family again, it will be completely forgotten, like some kind of a dream. So it's not that he has to stay in the treatment center forever, and it's not that he has to have remorse and grief forever. But once he gets past that, then the real relationship with the family begins. Now it's the meditating on the relationship with the family that gives them the impetus to go through the treatment program. So in that stage, it's more meditation on what's behind the door that gives him the impetus that I'm going to go through the treatment program and I'm going to get clean and I'm going to... But then you open the door, and you're not just meditating on something that's behind the door, you're starting to participate in it. It's all right? But if he says, I want to participate in it without going through the treatment program, they're simply not going to let him in. They're going to say, sorry. We love you very much, but you're stealing. You're lying, you're cheating, and you're stealing, and it doesn't matter how much we love you, we don't want you to steal from us, sorry. And because we love you, we want you to get treatment and get free of this. And the treatment will be somewhat painful. Is that the fault of the doctors in the treatment program, that the treatment is somewhat painful? No, because if you don't become an addict, you never have to go to the treatment program. Make sense? Yes? So if someone complains, oh, there's some suffering involved. Yes, but the suffering is involved because I became attached to material life, not because Krishna's mean or something. Someone else who hasn't asked something yet? Yes?
I want to stop being angry.
Have you stopped being angry? How do you stop being angry and keep loving if you've been hurt?
Yeah,
if you don't need anything from anybody. The only reason you feel angry is because you think you need something from somebody.
Well, what if it's like your family and you just let down?
Let down means you expect something. Yes?
Yeah.
I can't feel let down by people of whom I expect nothing. Some random stranger on the street, I expect nothing from them. So if they give me nothing, I don't feel angry, correct? All right, is that clear? Do you get that? You think so? Okay. Anger comes from feeling let down. Anger comes from this feeling, I need something. There's something I need that I don't have. And the way I'm gonna get this thing that I need that I don't have is I have to get it from you. I must get it from you. I cannot get it from somebody else. I mean, let's say I go to a shop to buy something and they don't have it and I can buy it from the shop next door. I'm not going to get angry, right? No. But if I think I have to get it from that shop, there's no other shop in all of London, I need it right now, I must have it right now, and this is the only shop and they don't have it, I might get angry. Why don't you have it? You're supposed to have it. You always have it. And I need it right now. It's an important meeting. If I don't have it for this meeting, I'm going to lose my job and all these things are going to happen and then we become angry. Right? But if they have it next door, I'm not going to become angry. So if I think, okay, I need something and I must get it from you. I don't have another source. If you don't give it to me, I'm just going to be empty. I'm going to suffer in some way. Then when we don't get it, we become angry. Krishna says it's attachment, fear, and anger. So all of our anger, unless it's spiritual anger, which is something completely different, but all of our anger is coming from that. It's coming from that I am empty, and I need certain things. I need shelter. I need love. I need meaning. I need peace. I need autonomy, I need freedom, I need all these things. And this is the only store selling it. And I might feel that I have a contract, especially in a family, we feel that we have a contract. You know, we feel we have a contract, that you're my family, and therefore we have a contract that you're supposed to give me these things. We have some sort of an agreement. And I'm giving you things. I'm giving you things with the understanding that by my giving you these things, I'm going to get certain things in return. And I've invested a lot. Maybe I could get them someplace else. Maybe it's possible to get them someplace else. But I've really invested here. I've invested my time, I've invested my energy, I've invested my emotions, my sacrifices, with the idea that by investing all these things, I'm going to get a certain thing back for me that I need. And when I don't get it, I become angry. And the anger is really a reaction to fear. I become afraid that I will not get these things that I need. And by things, I don't just mean like, you know, a car. I mean things like love and freedom and connection, communication, understanding, respect, consideration, autonomy, fun, play, all the human needs. I become afraid, and then anger is a way I go to try to force. It's a place I go when I can't, when I don't think I can get what I need through asking or through negotiation or through a contract, then I try to do it by force. It's kind of our little version of war. I can't get what I want from the other country by negotiation. I can't get what I, you know, through trade. I can't get it. Okay, I'm going to force. I'm going to point a gun to their head and shoot their people, and I'm going to keep shooting their people until they give me what I need. So this is what we do, except we shoot with our words instead of, hopefully, with guns. But that's what we're doing. You know, I'm going to injure you in some way. I'm going to try to force you. I'm going to put you in a position of difficulty so that I can get what I want. Okay, how do you get free from anger? You've got to feel full. There is no other option. If you think that you have needs that must be fulfilled by other living beings in this world, you will never become free from anger. Never, ever, 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 ever. You may be able to control your anger for some time, but it will flare up as soon as the need gets great enough. But if you feel full, and you don't have any needs because all your needs are being met. See, we often try to get rid of anger by pretending we don't have needs. Does not work. Well, I just don't care. I just don't care if anybody respects me. I don't care if anybody's considerate. I don't care if anybody loves me. I don't care if I have any meaning in my life. I don't care if I have any freedom. I don't care about any of these things. I just don't need any of them. But that's a bunch of bunk. And it just doesn't last, because we do need those things, because those things are all part of us, the soul. They're part of who we are. And we do need them. We need them very desperately. We need them actually more than we need air and temperature and water and all that kind of stuff. We're not able to function without them. Like Prabhupada says, the need of the soul is for freedom. It's a spiritual need. So we're just going to the wrong place. Go to the place where you can get them met. There's no other living being. The choice in London: be hot and suffocate, or have noise. Whatever you want to do. You can close it for now, but then please open it again later. But then pretty soon we'll be like... Sleeping here, it's like that every night, isn't it?
Yeah.
You have this choice. Is it going to be hot and stuffy and quiet? Or is it going to be refreshing and fresh air and noisy? Anyway, the only way is that you can get all your needs met. Now, if I already have all of my needs met, fully and completely, if I already feel complete love, and I already feel complete freedom, and I already feel complete autonomy and meaning and understanding and respect and consideration and fun and play and all of those things, then I can be detached as to whether you give them to me or not. And then my relationships with you are no longer contractual. I'm no longer doing things with you because I have a contract to get these things from you. Now I'm doing things for you completely voluntarily. I have everything I need. So I'm now relating with you and having a friendship with you, a relationship with you, only and completely and solely because I like you and I want a relationship with you, and not because I want to get anything from you. And if you reciprocate nicely with my relationship, that's wonderful and I'm grateful. And if you don't, then I have to decide, am I going to keep relating with you or not? But I don't have any anger. Because I don't have to try to force you to give anything, because I already have everything. You know, there's, generally speaking, there's a lot more crime when people are poor. Generally. People sometimes are criminal for other reasons. But generally, there's crime when there is inequality and there's poverty and people are in lack, yes? I mean, obviously, that's not the only reason people engage in crime. But that's one of the main reasons people engage in crime. So why will I try to force you to give me something that I already have in infinite supply? Would Bill Gates steal your money?
Yes.
Not directly. Not directly, no. He wouldn't come to your house and steal your wallet. Because he has more money than he can spend in his life. You follow? If I have an infinite supply of everything I need, I have no reason to try to force you, and all anger is forcing. Now, there is also a spiritual anger. That's an anger of love. That has nothing to do with forcing. And we see that a little bit. You see that a little bit. You know, if your child picks up a sharp knife, you might go, hey, put that down! You're not trying to force them to meet your needs. That's not what's happening there. But because you genuinely care about them, you become angry. So that's there is that kind of anger also in spirituality. Otherwise, there wouldn't be anger materially, because everything we have comes from God. It must exist in some form in God, and it must exist in some form in liberated souls. So it's not that an enlightened person never becomes angry. But when an enlightened person becomes angry, that they're using their temper rather than losing it, and it is an expression of ecstatic, blissful love. And it increases their feeling of love and freedom rather than some force that takes them over and makes them say and do things that very much embarrasses them a few minutes later. Is that all right?
Yeah.
So the only way I know is you've got to connect with Krishna and you've got to feel infinitely filled with Krishna. There's no other solution. And until you feel infinitely filled with Krishna, you just have to tolerate the fact that you're going to be angry sometimes. And see that, at least understand as an observer what's going on. At least be an observer to yourself and say, the reason that I'm angry is that I have this illusion of separateness from Krishna, I have an illusion of emptiness, and therefore I am trying to force something from another living being that they probably don't even have the capacity to give you, at least to the extent that you want it. Yes, sir?
Hare Krishna. No, it was just related to why not. I was going to ask if you, would you agree that anger could come from frustration, the feeling of frustration?
Frustration?
Yes.
Yeah, that you're not getting your needs met.
Exactly.
Yes. Frustration is sort of a mild form of anger. Yes. Yes.
It's impossible to see God 24/7. Mm, on one condition, he says, if we can avoid for seeing God, and avoid all ownership.
Yes.
Of all things. Which
yes.
Which needs a bit more spiritual intelligence.
Okay.
My question is, what is the best way to pass this test?
What is the best way to pass this test? See false ego for what it is, and then you'll naturally relinquish it. Ask Krishna, reveal to me the real form of my false ego. And then you'll despise it, and you won't want to go anywhere near it. Krishna says, ahankara ashrita, that materialistic persons think their false ego is their shelter. It's something like taking the shelter of a despotic evil government. Or, you know, somebody who falls in love with someone who's abusive. Or someone who keeps a python as a pet. And when you see the real nature of your shelter, you naturally relinquish it. False ego is very ugly. It's very evil. It's extremely evil and it's extremely ugly.
What is false ego?
False ego is a sense, I am the center of the universe. I am the Lord. I am the enjoyer. I am the controller. Everyone is meant to serve me. My happiness is in subjugating others and making them do my will. My happiness is enforcing and imposing my will upon others to make others an extension of myself. My happiness is in pushing others down and causing others pain and distress if they try to approach my level of opulence. I am the master of everything. I am the center. I am wonderful. Everybody, see me, worship me. I am great. It's a horrible thing. It's completely false. Logically, obviously, it's false. How am I the center of the universe? It's absurd. I mean, even the whole planet isn't the center of the universe. Even the whole Earth planet isn't at the center of the universe. In the universe, the Earth planet is completely insignificant. Even the solar system is insignificant. Even our solar system isn't the center of the universe. Even the Milky Way, even our galaxy isn't the center of the universe. So, and I'm sorry for all you Brits, but, you know, London is not the center of the universe either. I'm so sorry. You know, yeah, that hurts, doesn't it? You know, and my family is not the center of the universe, and I'm not the center of my family. You know, I'm not the center of my family, and my family's not the center of my city. My city's not the center of the world. The world's not the center of the solar system. The solar system's not the center of the galaxy. The galaxy's not the center of the universe. And according to the Shastra, there's lots and lots of universes, and this universe isn't even in the center of all the universes. Yeah, really. So, you know, I mean, really, I'm the center, and I'm the most important, and everybody should just serve me, and the way I'm going to be happy is if everyone does exactly what I want them to do, and if nature does exactly what I want it to do, and it rains when I want it to rain, and it's sunny when I want it to be sunny, and everybody treats me exactly the way I want them to treat me, and I get all the material things that I want exactly the way I want them, exactly how I want them, exactly when I want them, delivered right to my door on time. Thank you very much. It's crazy. It's madness. It's false. It's just, it's not real. It's not the truth. It's just simply not the truth. And how could we all be the center of the universe? That would be pretty interesting. Everybody's supposed to serve you, but everybody's supposed to serve you. And would you all agree? If I said, okay, all of you are supposed to serve me 24/7, you'd go, I don't think so. You know, who else is going to agree? And I'm not going to agree to serve you 24/7. So it's ugly. It's nasty. It's full of malice. It's full of envy. It's full of pride. So if you want to get rid of the false ego, ask to see what it is.
So we make Krishna as the center of the...
You don't make Krishna the center. He's already the center. You acknowledge that he's the center. You don't make him the center. He's already there. And we're not. And we'll never be. It's not our place. Each of us feel happiest when we're in our place. That's, if you want to talk, even if you're a materialist, okay, even if you're just a gross, atheistic, materialistic person, you're going to feel much happier using your own talents and your own nature and your own propensity in the service of something greater than yourself. Even if you have nothing to do with spiritual life. When you find your place, when you find, this is where I fit, this is where I belong. This is where I can really be myself in a way that contributes to the good of others. You'll feel much happier than if you're in a situation that doesn't feel like your place, or where you're not contributing to anything beyond yourself. We get the most pleasure when we can be completely, totally who we are in a situation of doing good for others and connecting with others, when we're fully ourselves and fully connecting with others in a way that's meaningful and beneficial for everybody involved. And again, that even if you're an atheist, that's true. What to speak of at the highest level of truth, where you really find out who you are actually really, that you're a soul and you're really connecting with all living beings and with God. So finding our real place gives us tremendous happiness, and trying to occupy, pretending that we're in a false place is just miserable. This is completely miserable. You know, pretending that you're the prima donna ballerina when you're the backup dancer just doesn't... It's not going to make anybody happy. Yes?
How can we make Krishna in the center?
You can't make Krishna the center. I told you, he's already there.
Krishna is always there in the center, but how can we feel it every moment in the action?
You can't feel it every moment until you have a certain degree of purification. It's not possible. So you practice as much as you can, behaving as if you believe that Krishna was the center. Pretend, at least, that you can see it. Accept it, at least theoretically. Okay, theoretically I accept that God's at the center, and I'm not. And then act on that belief, and because that belief is a true belief, as you act on that belief, you'll start to see it. And he'll be happy, and he'll show you. Is that okay? Have a couple more. Anybody who hasn't asked anything? Yes.
Ayurveda recommends the power of association, especially uplifting one. If we do not have access to it, can we also utilize books or see books as uplifting association?
Of course. Association does not just mean physical proximity. One of the great benefits of modern technology is it allows us to have saintly association in many, many, many forms. It's one of the... Technology is not all bad. The fact that we have printed books, electronic books, we have recordings, really facilitates us to have spiritual saintly association in ways that were not very possible 100 years ago. 200 years ago. Anybody else? Somebody who hasn't said anything? I first want to see if there's anyone who hasn't asked something, if that's okay. Yes?
You see Hare Krishna if you don't eat onions and mushrooms and stuff like that. If you still do eat it, I mean, what's...
Onions and garlic increase the amount of passion and ignorance in the body, which is why we don't eat them. As far as mushrooms, Srila Prabhupada said they're not prohibited, but they're not generally eaten. He said mushrooms are not prohibited and there's no harm, but they're not generally offered because they grow in darkness. But mushrooms are not prohibited, whereas onions and garlic are specifically prohibited. Onions and garlic do have some medicinal properties for certain diseases, both used externally and internally.
Uncooked.
So they have certain, for certain diseases, just like you might have certain diseases for which antibiotics might be a really wonderful blessing. There are certain diseases for which, boy, are you happy there's such a thing as antibiotics. But if you were to take antibiotics regularly, it would ruin your health completely. So onions and garlic are very much like that, that they develop modes of passion, ignorance in the body.
Why will Krishna come in the form of Hayagriva?
I don't know. He comes in all different forms. That's an interesting form, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know why he comes in that form, but he has all kinds of different forms. I think it's something like, do you ever like to get dressed up in a costume? Do you like to get dressed up? Do you like to get dressed up?
Yeah.
Do you like to? Yeah, so I think that's like Krishna too. He likes to play in all different forms. He's very playful. Krishna's very young, you know. Krishna's always a young boy. He never really grows up. And so he's very playful. And because God is very playful, he likes to take all different forms and all different moods and have all different games. For him, it's all games. Has to play all different games in all these different forms. Is that all right?
I have one more question.
Sure, what's that?
Why we can't play games at the home?
Why can't we play games what? Why can't you play games on the phone? Well, you could probably play games on the phone if they would help you remember Krishna. So we have some games on the phone that will help you remember Krishna. We have one game on the phone called Did Krishna Do It? So you can play games on the phone if they help you remember Krishna. But you have to talk to your mommy and daddy about that.
I have learned to read books by you.
Okay, that's good. But you have to ask your mommy and daddy how much they want you to play games on the phone, okay? But some of the games, you know, just like any other game, so some games are good for you, and some games are kind of not so good, and some games are really bad, and it's like anything else. Some games are good, some games are bad. Some food is good, some food is bad. You understand? Yeah. Okay, is that all right? So you get very nice parents, and they'll help you play games that are good for you. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.